Everyone please put their cell phones on silent or vibrate, except for the person who will be made fun of later for not doing it. Birshut Rav, Birshut Rav HaGuest Shalom. Without having Sundays, all of us, we appreciate how difficult it is, how challenging it is to find time to commemorate things. So thank you very much, everybody, for deciding that, you know, of those few moments you have to put aside for things you want to do, that you've all decided that this would be one of them. It means a lot to me. And I think it's going to be worth your time. I have a couple of individual thank yous, a few thoughts about my grandmother, and then I'll be introducing Rav Khan. First of all, I'd like to thank my mom and stepdad who are here tonight from the States. Thank them for just being who they are, but also to thank them for sponsoring this. As I've mentioned in years past, when I first approached my mom about doing something like this for the benefit of Nana's, her mom's neshama, my mom didn't hesitate for a moment before giving me the green light to move ahead, and so I really appreciate it. I hope you appreciate it. At last year's event, my sister Ilana was here with her friend Liran. I'm happy to report that they're now engaged, so if anyone has a chance afterward, give my mom and stepdad a mazel tov. Of course, thank you to my son Ezra for being here also. I love you very much, Ez. I also want to thank Rabbi David for everything he does for our family and community, but specifically tonight for supporting the idea of this somewhat controversial topic. I also want to thank, or I should say acknowledge, the presence of Dr. Baruch and Judy Sturman. Baruch is one of the founders of Petil Techelet, of the organization. He's also one of the two people who, 21 years ago, whatever it was, 22 years ago, something like that, put on the scuba gear, took hold of a net, and dove into the Mediterranean to catch the first of many, many Murex trunculus snails that have provided the blue tchelet dye we all use on our tzitzit today. It's an honor to have you here. It's an honor to know you. It's an honor to work with you and the rest of the Petil Tchelet team. And I've more recently gotten to know Judy, who we all understand deserves at least 90% of the credit for everything Baruch has done, the same way my wife deserves at least 90% of the credit for everything I've done. Every year we bring in a special speaker who's able to speak on a topic that connects with Nana, my grandmother. The first year we did this, Rav David Kaplan spoke about the importance of family. In year two, Rav Ken Spiro discussed the importance of accepting people as they are through the lens of the challenges between the Haredi and non-Haredi communities of Beit Shemesh. Last year, Rav Yitzhak Reidowitz covered the topic of one's loyalty to his or her native country, in my case the U.S., in the context of our position as Olim. And Nana was a big U.S. patriot. So this year you may think it's a stretch to have Rav Khan speak about Techelet, but it's not such a far leap at all to connect this topic with my grandmother. My grandmother, Rivka Bat Leib Hirsch, was born in 1911 and owned a business with my grandfather for more than 65 years. She had two daughters, my mom and my aunt Bert, and five grandchildren. Along with my mother-in-law, Zichrona Livracha, Nana was one of the two most amazing people I've ever met in my life. She was a strong, modern American woman with a dental hygienist degree from Columbia University, and at the same time a wonderful homemaker. She ran the finances for the store that she and my grandfather owned, and she also was able to give and give and give so much love to all of us when we were growing up, in the way only a grandmother can. The first time I visited Israel at the age of 26, it was her words I had in my head as I approached the Kotel for the first time. "There's just something about the place that made me cry," she once told me. There are lots of stories about Nana, but for tonight, I want to focus on her store, and you'll see why soon enough. Nana and Papi owned a men's and boys' clothing store called Weber's. I used to get all my clothes from there, and there was a whole section of the store devoted to blue jeans. She didn't carry Levi's, but she did carry Lee jeans. I looked up Lee jeans, by the way, and I'm sorry to report that unlike Levi Strauss, Mr. Lee was not Jewish. There's no question that those non-Jewish Lee jeans that Nana carried in her store were tchelet in color. We spent a lot of time in that store growing up, and I was fortunate enough financially and unfortunate enough style-wise to always get my clothes from Nana's store, Weber's on Broad Street in Palisades Park, New Jersey. So the surface connection here is between clothing and Nana's store and the blue fringes on our four-cornered garments called tchelet. But there's more to it. I've also had the honor of learning with and from Stu Schrader, Ira Winkler, Johnny Gross, and Alan Schwartz for the last couple of months about the clothing that the Kohen Gadol wears in our Daf Yomi Shir on Tractate Yoma, all about Yom Kippur and the Beit HaMikdash. So this is also relevant to tonight's talk, or at least to the title of tonight's talk. We are, according to many people who are much more knowledgeable than I am, in the middle of a very exciting time for the Jewish people. We are in the generation preceding the arrival of Mashiach. I just listened to a shiur this morning on the way to work from Rav Ari Kahn about this week's Parsha Mishpatim, where he discusses the significance of Na'aseh v'Nishma, traditionally translated as we will do and we will listen. We're not going to get into that now, but from when the Jewish people were in the process of receiving the Torah. In that shiur, Rav Kahn says something that to me was quite significant. Excuse the paraphrase, please. He said, the giving of the Torah on Har Sinai was the most significant event in the history of the world. Then he paused and said, until today, I can't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So I paused the shiur and I thought, whoa, that's a seriously intense idea. And I'm not sure he meant it this way, although I could probably find out tonight. But I took it as maybe the Geula is going to come tomorrow. Maybe Mashiach is going to be revealed this week. Who knows? But one thing's for sure, as we get closer and closer to the Messianic time, we're facing a lot of questions, from issues related to the majority of Jews living in the land of Israel, to having the ability, at least according to the letter of the law of the state of Israel, to ascend Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, to how we're going to all daven when the Geula is here, which Nusach we're going to use. Lots of questions about mitzvot that were, for lack of a better term, dormant for a very long time. So for tonight, the question is tchelet, and as the title says, other rediscovered mitzvot. Now, I've listened to enough shirim of Rav Ari Kahn to know that titles other people give to his shirim are at best a bit of a guide for the talk, and at worst,
suggestion.
At worst, a vehicle for Rav Kahn to crack a joke about how little he cares about the title he's been given. But that's okay, because Rav Ari Kahn never, ever disappoints. You know, I copied and pasted the bio that's on his website, but it seems so silly. Let me tell you why I invited Rav Kahn to be here. Rav Kahn is a creative thinker, and as someone who's in at least a career, if not a life, that's all about creativity, I appreciate creative thinking. But creative thinking also has to be grounded in reality and something a little more credible than just your creativity. And that's what I've always appreciated about Rav Kahn. He does happen to be director of the foreign student program at Bar-Ilan University, et cetera, et cetera. He himself was a student of the Rav Soloveitchik. Most importantly, he's a terrific writer and actually has some books outside for after that I hope you guys brought money because his books are really worth it. He made Aliyah in 1984. And so with all of us having in mind, please, that all the Torah we learn tonight will be for an aliyah, for the neshama of Rivka Bat Leib Hirsch Nana, I'm honored to introduce Rav Ari Kahn. By the way, that was a stretch.
I'm going to talk a little about Tchelet, but if you really want to learn about it, you'll buy Baruch's book and Judy's book, because it's far. If I accomplish anything tonight, it will be to at least whet your appetite for their book, and then you can actually learn about the topic. And I will speak about what you asked for. This is the times that I don't stick to the script is when they surprise me with a topic, which, believe me, has happened. Now, the way that you framed it was what to do about Tchelet, and I will speak about Tchelet. Excuse me, B'chvod Mara D'As, Rabbi David. I will speak about Tchelet. I'm going to speak about it in a way, actually, which Rabbi David will either be happy or very upset with me. It will not be in the middle. It will be one or the other. Because my approaching this topic is approaching it from the perspective of hopefully being a Ben Torah and hopefully being a student of the Rav. And that, for anybody who understands, and I'll explain exactly, that creates certain limitations and certain possibilities, and that's part of what I'm going to deal with. When I say deal with it as a Ben Torah, I literally 5 minutes before I left my house, I had a student from a couple years ago contact me and ask me, and he quoted some rabbi, and I can say that with a question mark, and he told me what the rabbi said. So I said, it's heresy, what the rabbi said, I won't tell you what it was unless you really asked me afterwards. I said, it was absolute heresy what the person said, because according to that approach, you can just destroy all of Judaism, which I know sounds much more interesting than anything I'm going to talk about, but... that's okay. The issue, though, is not just rediscovered mitzvot. It's actually an orientation to halacha, which I don't want to say has been discovered, but we have new challenges which we face today compared to, let's just put it this way, before World War I. Before World War I, the world was different. Before World War I, we lived in communities. Before World War I, there were set communities and set community practice, and that changed. And as much as we think of World War II as being the major cataclysm, it's true it was a cataclysm, but it really started beforehand, which is the major shifts of population, people going to places, people losing their traditions, or people going to places where there are new traditions, all happened at that particular juncture. And the question then is really what you do about it. You see, over here, living in Israel today, and again, if this was just a little bit closer to Pesach, then the only question people would be asking about would be kitnias, right? That's the major challenge we have in Judaism today is kitnias. I don't want to say who, but a certain woman I'm married to. A week without hummus is like, how can we imagine such a thing? This is... Rice. This is cruel and unusual and so on. It's called Mitzrayim, Tsar, right? We have a challenge coming to Israel, and part of the challenge for a lot of us is also going to be living in different cultures at once, which means the Ashkenazic Sephardic challenge within the last, I would say, 50 years, is much different than that challenge has been for the last 2,000 years. So how to deal with halacha, or is it halacha or halacha? What is it? Okay. So how to deal with halacha is part of the issue. There's a remarkable tshuva by one of the important Rosh Yeshiva and Poskim in Israel today, Rav Nachum Rabinovich from Ali Adumim. He has one after the other, Pei Zayin and Pei Chet, in his Shut Siach Nachum. In Pei Zayin, he raises the question of creating a new Nusach Tefillah. Now, that's a statement that can scare a lot of people. What do you mean, creating a new Nusach Tefillah? He says, what do we do? The question he says, what do we do in a community where we have some Ashkenazim, some Sfaradim, some Temanim, some, and now keep going, dot, dot, dot. What do we do? So he says, okay, so you take turns. He goes in yeshiva. And when I learned in yeshiva as well, they took turns. Whoever went up for the Yomid, that's how they davened. What do you do, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? So he ends up saying at the end, Kan kach b'meshach hazman yitgabesh Nusach Achid. As time goes on, a new reality is going to create itself. By the way, that's a very appropriate statement for a sociologist. For a sociologist to say that's a very interesting statement. It's a true statement. For a rabbi to say it, it's much more radical. In the following tshuva, he asks, Ha'im ishat tzrich, he's asked, Ha'im ishat tzricha lakabel et minhagei ba'ala? Some of you may be intrigued with that question. I'll just read his last paragraph. Lefi ani da'ati, in my humble opinion, yesh makom lahakel b'davar zeh, kevon she'anu chayim b'tkufat shel kibbutz galiot v'yitzirat kihilot chadashot. He gives the same sociological answer. We're creating something new and where we are, a new reality is being created on the ground. V'dayin lo gubshu minhagei hamakom. And we have not, as of yet, established the minhag of this place. Again, that's just, it's an unbelievable statement that he's making. But ultimately, and again, as a sociologist, what he's saying, it's true. As a posek, it's surprising that he actually gets up and says this, but it's quite interesting. Regarding many of the questions that you wanted me to get to, his answer is correct. That as time moves on, these quote-unquote new mitzvot are going to become clarified, and people who have Yirat Shamayim, who are B'nai Torah, who are going to live within communities, something new is going to be established. And by the way, this is going to touch on all kinds of things, including going to Har HaBayit, which I cannot possibly understand why people do it. I don't see how whatever you accomplish is worth the risks. That's my own personal opinion. I know that there are very significant people, far more significant than I, who disagree with me on this. They think that something wonderful can be accomplished. I think if you take out political considerations, which maybe is why I'm naive, and you look at it purely halachic, then I don't see how it's worth it, but maybe I made a mistake in my analysis. Regarding this sociological issue of creating a new community, it's going to have an impact on all kinds of things, which I'd be smarter not to mention, including how, especially women, your grandmother was a woman, correct? This is an easier stretch than yours. including how women dress, including how women cover their hair, and these things are based upon how communal norms and how things are established, and that's something which is still in flux, even though the way Beit Shemesh is moving, it seems to be quite clear. Anyway. Okay, I'll be nice. I won't be nice. Okay. I will point out something. And you spoke of creativity before. If we look at Jewish history, cataclysms generally do not breed creativity. Cataclysms generally breed this feeling that everything is disappearing, we need to collect. It's not a coincidence that the Mishnah, which gets published, happens after both the destruction of the second base of Migdash and after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. It's not a coincidence that the Yerushalmi gets published after there's an earthquake which totally decimates Eretz Yisrael. It's not a coincidence that the Shulchan Aruch emerges after Judaism of Spain, Portugal are expelled. And we can move on and see great collections generally take place as a result of cataclysms. One of the things that happened as a result of the destruction of Judaism in Europe, the Second World War, the Holocaust, in my opinion, and this is certainly a debatable point, is the preeminence of the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah is not a classical sefer. The Mishnah Berurah, had everybody still lived in their own towns and had their own customs, the Mishnah Berurah never would have enjoyed the same type of acceptance. It was only within the vacuum that was created as communities were destroyed that the Mishnah Berurah became such an important sefer. And again, there's many points along the way. I will focus for the most part now on one particular mitzvah, and that is the mitzvah of Tchelet. The mitzvah of Tchelet is part of the mitzvah of Tzitzit. There's no two separate mitzvot. There's one mitzvah, and that mitzvah is to wear on a four-cornered garment that you happen to wear, that one should put strings on. Those strings should have some type of a ratio, that's a machloket, between the blue and the white. And if one does not have the blue, one still fulfills the mitzvah. If one has the blue, then one fulfills the mitzvah in a more perfect way. So that's all we're talking about, is a more perfect way to fulfill the mitzvah. On the other hand, simple Torah logic would take us to a place where we would say, and this may be overly simple Torah logic, would say, if I have a suffik deraita, l'chumra. If I have a doubt and I have a possibility of fulfilling it, so then why are I not machmir and go ahead and try to fulfill that obligation? As I said, that's simple Torah logic. The first person in modern times who tried to use that logic was a very special individual who's known as Rabbi Gershon Chana Kleiner from Rajin, the Rajina Rebbe. And by the way, before I go further, just full disclosure, that I do happen to wear tchelet, just in case you'll be wondering all the way through, I'll tell you now I do, and therefore may all the words I say be perceived through my own personal bias. I'm perfectly fine with that. Aside from all the logic involved and questions that I went through and asking permission from my father, who does not, I also had at least four different issues of what I felt was Saita Dishmaya pointing me in this particular direction, which is probably more interesting than anything that I'm going to talk about, but I also won't mention them tonight. The Rajina Rebbe, who was a brilliant man, and his credentials as a Talmud Chacham cannot be questioned by anybody, he decided that this was a mitzvah that can be reestablished, and he went and he searched, and he felt that he found, at the time, what was the best candidate. And I want to leave it in those words. I don't know if he himself was convinced 100% he had found Tchelet, but he certainly found what he felt was the best candidate, and he decided that he was trying to push people. And basically, the logic is Safek Deraita L'Chumra. You have a possibility fulfilling a Torah obligation, so why not? Meaning, what do you have to lose? And by the way, that question itself, what you have to lose, one can give a whole class on that question, what you have to lose, and even at the end of the entire discussion where people have put forth possible answers, what you have to lose, at the end of the day, it could be that they're unconvincing arguments, what one may have to lose. He suggested something called the cuttlefish, and it met a number of the criteria, and he had very limited success, which means most of the quote-unquote Gedolei Hador did not accept it. And we need to understand what the objections were. So, coming from where I come and from where Rabbi David comes, we have a very clear tradition which Rabbi Soloveitchik mentioned on many occasions and wrote about. And I'll read a citation from one of the drashot, which was given in his father's memory. And the Rav writes as follows. This is on page 228. And here, discussing Mesorah tradition generally, the Rav makes the following observation, or he reports the following. Yadua ma she'ira bein zikni hagon Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi ubein ha'admor hagon mirajin benogei l'tcheles betzitzis. He goes, it's well known what happened between my great-grandfather, and I'll add namesake, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Beis HaLevi, and the Rebbe from Rajin. Shaharebi Mirajin chidsha v'tziva l'kol chasidav l'tihil tcheles betzitziotehim. The Rebbe, he reestablished, he found, and he ordered his followers to put the blue on their tzitzis. Admur nisa lochiach yisod harbei ra'ayos, and he tried to bring many, many proofs. Ki atzeva hazeh hu be'emet ha'tchelet. And he tried to bring proof that what he found was real tchelet. Rav Yosef dov ta'an keneged. On the other hand, the Beit HaLevi argued, v'amar she'ein ra'ayot v'sferot yucholot lochiach shum davar b'milei tishchichi l'mesorat she'el avicha v'yagedcha. The Beit HaLevi's argument was that when it comes to certain points of tradition, one cannot figure out tradition based on logic. Tradition can only be passed on by tradition, which means either you have a tradition or you don't have a tradition. If you have a tradition, then you keep your tradition. If you don't have a tradition and it's something which necessitates a tradition, which the Beit HaLevi felt this was, which means, let's just say, for example, somebody will come tomorrow and try to convince us that a different type of lemon is really an esrog. Are any of us going to give up on the esrog we've been using our entire lives? I think not. And that exactly is the point of the Beis HaLevi. Things which are subject to tradition, only tradition can solve the problem. Logic is not the issue. That's the argument that the Rav brings from the Beis HaLevi. Again, Sham ein hasfura machria ki im hamesora atzma. Logic cannot win the day, only tradition. Kach ro avot v'kach yinogim v'kach tzrichin lenhog habanim. That is the way the ancestors behaved, and that's the way the children must behave. And therefore, he says this, which means it's a non-starter. There's nothing to talk about. Which means the response of the Beit HaLevi, according to the way it's reported here, is that there's nothing to talk about, even if we find, through all kinds of scientific data, experiments, signs, that this is, in fact, chelet, there's nothing that one can do about it. It still doesn't make a difference because we've lost the tradition. That's the argument that the Rav says in the name of his great-grandfather, the Beit HaLevi. I spoke yesterday to a member of the Soloveitchik family, and he told me he so much wants to wear chelet, but he can't. Why can't he? He can't because of the Beit HaLevi. I did tell him what he could do, but I won't tell you yet because that would ruin everything else I want to say. Rav Schechter, in his Nefesh HaRav, quotes this Beit HaLevi, but he also quotes something else, or he almost quotes something else, which is interesting. He quotes over here in a footnote, this is in Nefesh HaRav on page 53, he writes, Ta'anazu lo huva'a b'sifro shel hagon Rav Gershon Henoch, which means the Rishiner Rebbe was contacted by the Beit HaLevi, and he gave a different argument, or he's quoted differently. Now, I'm not going to read it the way that Rav Schechter quotes it, because there's a subtlety here which is missing. Instead, I'll read it from the way that the Rishiner Rebbe actually writes it. Assuming I find it. He writes the various correspondence, because he tried to convince everybody, and he writes one of the people that contacted him, Umehem Hagon Av Beitin Brisk Delita. That's the Beit HaLevi. Sheyichya, may he live. Masar Kol Ta'amo V'Nimuko B'Dvar Mi'uno B'Mitzvah HaTchelet. He gave all of his reasons why he hesitates or rejects the mitzvah of Tchelet. Le'echad mi miyuadenu sheyichtov v'yomer lanu mishmo. So he just now reported something very interesting, and this is the point that Rav Schechter misses. What is it? The Beit HaLevi did not write to him. He asked someone to write to him. Okay? And if you want to know why I'm making such a big deal about it, it's very simply. The way the Rav reports the Beit HaLevi, I could not find, by the way, the lo ra'inu ein araya, the fact I couldn't find doesn't mean anything, but I could not find anybody else reporting the Beit HaLevi the way that the Rav reports it. In fact, the opposite is true. The way that the Beit HaLevi is reported by the Rishiner Rebbe is completely, completely different, and it actually opens up a very, very big door, as you're about to hear. But, again, I hesitate, because the Beit HaLevi isn't writing. And we'll go through the various possibilities in a second. First, listen to what he says. He asked one of his acquaintances, Mimiyudenu Sheikh Tov, to write, V'yomulanu Mishmo, to say in his name, B'zeh HaLashon, with these exact words. Okay, so this is what the Beit HaLevi asked to be conveyed. He said, Kvo Ma'alato, referring to the Rishiner Rebbe, Lo bi'ir b'dvarav, Mazot matza achar shenishkach. He didn't reveal what it was that was found after it was lost. Im mitziat hadag, o hatzaat tziv'o. Is it that you found the fish that was lost, or did you find the color that was lost? What exactly have you done? V'rak acharei shekvod ma'alato yivarer zot, and only after the Rebbe will reveal exactly what it is that he did. Hainu haya b'zed devar hanishkach v'hu matza. Is it that something was lost and was found? Az nihiyeh mechuyavim l'shmoa alav ulolvasho. If it was something that was lost and then found, we would then all be required to do it. Hold it a second. This was not in the way the Rav recorded the Beit HaLevi. Just in case any of you missed what I just now said, I will explain and then go a little bit further. The way the Rav says over his great-grandfather's teaching is there are certain things which are subject to Mesorah, and if you've lost the Mesorah, there's nothing to talk about. The way the Rishiner Rebbe reports the Beit HaLevi's objections is the exact opposite. I'll tell you what he says, and then I'll read a little bit more. He says, if the fish was always known, and the methodology was always known, and yet we weren't doing this for the last 1,800 years, that's proof that whatever you're doing is wrong. Should I say that again? If everyone knew the fish, and people knew the color, and we didn't do it, the fact that we didn't do it is proof that you're wrong. But if we didn't know the fish, or we didn't know the color, and you've discovered it, then I would start doing it as well. One second. Did you all understand the difference over here? Let me read it just in case you think I'm making it up. This is an introduction of one of the number of books that the Regina wrote about Tchelet. Again. Kvod malato lo bi'er bidvarav mazot matzah achasher nishkach. Im mitziah tadag o tzat tzivo. V'rak acharei asher kvod malato yivarer zot. If something was lost and that was found, again, this is diametrically opposed to what I said in the name of the Rav, then we would be obligated. Why? But if the fish was around, but if how to process it was known, from the time that Tchelet stopped, nonetheless, they didn't use it. He says this is a negative mesorah. If we had the fish and had the process and we didn't use it, then we have a negative mesorah and we can't, and therefore we have proof that we can't use it. But if you found something new, then we can use it and we'd be obligated to use it. So, at this point, I will readily admit I have no idea what to do. Because over here we have two different ways that the Beit HaLevi has been brought down. So, what are our possibilities in analysis? Yeah. It could be. It could be his quote. It could be. He's quoting the Beit HaLevi. All I'm trying to do is figure out what the Beit HaLevi said. I don't know. I'll get back to that if you like. I'll get back to that if you like. Okay? But he's basing himself on the Beit HaLevi. And he says, you know, the whole world was shook up by what the Beit HaLevi said. And over here we have the Beit HaLevi. So, here are your possibilities. First one, which I don't like, and that is that the Rav has a mistake in Mesorah. I don't like it. Okay? Anybody troubled that I don't like it? I don't like that. And the Rav was so careful about it, especially family Mesorah. He was so careful about it. To say that the Rav just didn't understand the Beit HaLevi, to me, is very difficult. But again, it's one of my possibilities. I searched to see if we can find the same Beit HaLevi being transmitted by others other than the Rav, including the Brisker Rav, the Grizz, including others. I have not found it in clear ways yet. I'm looking for that. Again, I wouldn't be surprised to find it. That would not surprise one at all. Second possibility is that the Beit HaLevi was misunderstood by the letter writer. Okay, it's also that he got it completely backwards. Listen, I've seen answers that my students give on tests. It's completely possible that he got it backwards. Next, it's possible that the Regina misunderstood or is misquoting it the way that it was said. I also don't like that. It's also possible the Beit HaLevi gave one answer to the Regina and gave another answer to his family, which, by the way, I like a little bit more. I know you may not like this, but I like that a little bit more. The reason I like it a little bit more is that it fits more into a brisker approach. For your own self, you keep certain chumras and you say certain things and you have your own hesitations, but in terms of the way that you pass in Klal Yisrael, it may be somewhat different. There is a lot to talk about this, but I'm saying that actually may be the most logical possibility is that the Beit HaLevi said both. He said to his own family, this is what my problem with it is. And when he wrote to the Regina, he was a little bit nicer and said, if this is the case, then you know, well, I'd be following you right away, even though he himself had his own obligations. But as I said, you're left with the steer. You can resolve this any way that you want. I don't have a problem. The second objection, which is introduced towards Tchelet, is an objection which, for lack of anyone else, I'll say you can find it in a sefer, it's called Yeshua Malcho by Hagon Mikutna, where he says that it's well known that the Tchelet was Ganuz. It was Ganuz. So what does it mean that it was Ganuz? So this is based upon a couple of different midrashim. I'll start with the Tanchuma. Tanchuma is found in Parashat Shlach, which is appropriate. It says, "V'yaseh mein tzitid ela mitzvah lahavi lavan v'tchelet v'yaseh eimatai kishayet tchelet v'achshav ein lanu el lavan shetchelet nignaz mitzvah bilavan." That now that the tchelet has been nignaz, and the problem is, what does nignaz mean over here? Does nignaz mean that it was deliberately hidden away? Or is it a halacha? Let me put it this way. Is that we don't have an opportunity because we don't know what it is, and that's what it means by nignaz, that we don't have it. Unfortunately, we don't have it. Or does it mean that, no, there's some kind of a halacha over here? To force this into halacha is a little bit more difficult. There's also a sifri, which is significant, which also speaks about it being ganuz. On the other hand, there are other ma'amarei chazal, there are other sources which speak about Tchelet existing even at much later times than we would have expected. And essentially, even calling it ganuz, it became rare, it became very rare, and it disappeared eventually. To turn the ganuz into halacha, to say that there's a halacha that it's ganuz, and therefore one can't use it, is something which is a little bit strange, because based on what is it ganuz? Again, based on what? Again, you have a mitzvah asay from the Torah. So what does it mean that it was hidden away? Now, if one is looking for a theological, or for that matter, a Kabbalistic perspective, one can find one, which is actually very difficult in terms of non-Kabbalistic thinking, and that is one can find from the Arizal a statement that only during the time when the Beit HaMikdash exists do we have Tchelet. If there's no Beit HaMikdash, then there's no Tchelet. I mean, the problem with that is that it's simply not true. And that there was still Tchelet during post-temple times, all the way towards the times of Amorim, and we still find that there were some rare uses of Tchelet. So to say that it's absolutely, totally correlated with the existence of the Beit HaMikdash, as I said, it's a very nice Kabbalistic idea which we can spend time trying to understand, but as far as a halachic basis for it, is a little bit strange. But that seems to be the approach which is taken over here, that it's ganuz, and once it's ganuz, then one really has no right to use it. This approach was actually attacked by the Regina Rebbe himself. He went to war against this, and he said, listen, we have a Mishnah at the end of Sota, which gives us a whole list of things that disappeared at various points in time that will one day come back. And we have, again, various Gemara like this, and he goes, this is not listed as one of them. So it's simply not listed as one of them, so then how could you say that there's some kind of a halacha? Even Rev Elyashiv quotes this in passing. Others as well quote this in passing, that it's ganuz. But again, one just has to question and say, okay, so it's, what does ganuz mean? Does ganuz mean, I know I'm repeating myself, does it mean that I unfortunately don't have access to it? Or does it mean that it's deliberately buried away? And if it's deliberately buried away, you have to ask again, why? Why should such a thing be the case? The once in 7 years is already brought down in the Gemara. And there's a Geras in the Tosefta there once in 7 years. Sorry. Tzitzis. Sorry. You did your homework. We'll get back to the Tosefta. Belina there. The Arizal writes, Vidaki, this is again Rav Chaim Vital, Vidaki, Shnei Minei Tzitziot Heim, Hatchele V'Lavan, Ratzalomaki, Bezman Shebeit HaMikdash Kayam, Hoyachut Tchelet Im Lavan, V'Zman Ezeh, Lo Yesh Ki Im Lavan. Okay, so that's an Arizal, but as I said, he then goes in and gives a Kabbalistic reason for this. The problem with saying that it is absolutely ganuz as a halacha, and what I'm about to say is a little subtle. One is both the Rif and the Rush, who generally don't speak about things which are hilchot de mishicha, they both mention Tchelet. They both mention them, which seems to be that if it's halacha that it's ganuz, that they are unaware of that halacha. And that, even though that sounds subtle, that's a much better argument than you think it is. Because that means that they're not aware of what other later authorities are saying, because then they wouldn't have brought it. So I'm saying, in terms of halachic thinking, it's actually a very good point. The other is the Maharil. The Maharil deals with the question of making tzitzit out of pishtan. And he says, you shouldn't make it out of pishtan. Why? And I'll quote the exact line. He goes, it could be that we're going to end up finding the tchelet, and therefore we're going to start making it out of tchelet again. He goes, no, that's a problem. Which means, again, just as in halachic discussion in passing, he says, no, we may find the tchelets. Right? So the Maharil, again, Maharil is a very important individual when we speak about Ashkenazic minhag and halacha. And the Maharil doesn't seem to be aware of this halacha, that the tchelet was nignaz, that itself is a good argument. So I'm saying, if you're looking for early sources who don't know about this later argument, or I think actually contradict it, the Rif and the Rush and the Maharil are three fairly sturdy legs that we could stand on. Nonetheless, we'll find those, as I said, Rav Yashiv in passing, and more specifically, Rav Chaim Kanevsky, taking this approach. Reb Chaim goes to war against the new Tchelet. And all that I'll say about this is that I get the suspicion that had one of the followers of the Chazon Ish come up with the idea, that he would not be as strong against it as he is. And I do think that that's part of the issue. I'm sorry for saying it that way. That if it's something which essentially emerges out of a Dati Lumi world where it's much more accepted than in other places, I do think that that may impact the thinking. And the thinking may be as simple as this. And I see this in his words, especially in some footnotes over here, which I'm not going to quote everything, but it's almost like, well, the Chazon Ish didn't do it, so then how can you have a chumra which the Chazon Ish didn't think of? I'm really sorry for putting it in those terms. But it's part of what I think is his halachic reasoning. And on the other hand, his reliance upon the Chazon Ish, and for that matter, Rav Yashiv's as well, is unfortunate for two reasons. One, I'll leave the second and more important reason about the Chazon Ish for a second. But they're only dealing in their discussions with what was discussed by the Rishiner. They don't deal with the newer Tchelet, which Rav Herzog first in his genius was able to identify without being able to process it, and then when it was actually processed, which means the Murex, exactly how do you pronounce the Murex, what's the second part? Okay. Whatever. So the newer candidate for Tchelet is much stronger than the old candidate. For many, many reasons. And the objections that they're raising seem to all be objections about something from 100 years ago. I mean, part of it, yes, we've been through this already. Gedolei Yisrael all the time didn't accept it, nothing to talk about. Hold it. You know, it's not the same discussion. I'll read to you a couple of tshuvas that Reb Chaim Kanevsky has on it. In one thing he writes, just see where this begins. Yeah. She'ela. This is Sefer Dat Nota from Reb Chaim Kanevsky. Ha'im yesh makom lahachmir l'ma sheyesh om shematzu et ha'tchelet ha'amiti to ha'af im einu kidvreim lo yezeh elu lavan tshuva ein bedvreim ma'ma she'chazal omru she'tchelet nignaz. Again, on a halachic level, I find this astounding. Again, I'm sorry to argue with Chaim Kanevsky, I just find this astounding that he's going to use that midrash, which, as I said, was rejected by the sources I quoted earlier, and say, no, it's nignaz. V'i'ef sher lahamtzi dinim chadashim b'hasharot be'alma. And you can't create new laws with, like, wild guesswork. B'li kabbalah me'avoteinu. And what's great about b'li kabbalah me'avoteinu is that here he adopts the Rav's understanding of the Beit HaLevi, and he has no other source for this. Next, question. Emotai nignaz hatchelet v'gemar menachot muvorad to be mea ma'arayim hayodain tchelet. When was it nignaz? Which again contradicts the Arizal. When was it nignaz? So he writes, tshuva tchelet nignaz b'sof yimei marayim kedita b'midrash l'chein l'ktiv b'tchelet l'dorotam k'mashakatav o'orachayim. It only says that tzitzit l'dorotam doesn't say the tchelet l'dorotam, so therefore tchelet is not l'dorotam, which is also a very funny drasha. She'ila benalhum v'u'ar b'gemar menachot. So he doesn't like that at all. He says, lo yitachen. He then goes on and again asks more questions. Again, question after question regarding the tchela, and he keeps pushing it off. Ein ra'ayot berot u'mashiach emir tzashem yaviyat tchela. That's it. It's, by the way, the Lubavitcher Rebbe gives the same answer. When will it be revealed? Kmo kol dvrim shenignezu ve'ein atidin legalot ad yavo goel. And he goes on and on giving these kinds of answers. Should you wear it? Misafek? Adif lo lulvo shashal yushavu shidat chelet. So again, he's 100% convinced that it's not chelet. There's nothing to talk about. Hasharot ba'alma. So, you know, slow down a second. Especially today, when, you know, given the archaeological evidence, which is absolutely breathtaking, and already you can say now, Pishtei Edim Yakum Dover, that there's more than one piece of archaeological evidence that you're able to actually look at this and see it and study it, the DNA, and so on and so forth. To say that this is a Hasharah Ba'alma, where they found a Tchelet factory on the one place and they found actual Tchelet another place, I'm not sure exactly why this would be labeled Hasharot Ba'alma, where it fits into all of the signs and quite the opposite from the way the Beit HaLevi was brought by the Rebbe from Rizhin, according to what he's saying there. If you have substantial reason to believe that it's correct, then it already becomes suffix right to the Chumra. Again, the Rav's objection, leave on the side. The other thing which is interesting is I actually found a conversation that the Chazon Ish had about Tchelet. And in the Chazon Ish's conversation, which is a book called Ma'aseh Ish, Volume 1, page 232. The Chazon Ish says, he's asked, "Halo ing shum hezik bedavar latil safek tchelet?" And then he answers, "Ve'ilu hayat sel tzilo shel safek, halo hayu hagdolim azay mekablim oto." If there was a tzel tzilo shel safek, which means that the Chazon Ish's point is that the Regina Tchelet was not a possibility, was not really a candidate. If there was even a suffix, the Chazon Ish is saying, then you're right, you say suffix to right to Lechomra. By the way, this is completely opposite of what Chaim Kanevsky says. Chaim Kanevsky is not following the Chazon Ish on this. He's following Rav Yashiv on this, who's his father-in-law. But he very often gives the impression that he's following the teachings of the Chazon Ish. He's not. The Chazon Ish over here is saying, if there was a tzel tzelo shel safek, then they would have followed. Just there was no safek there. There's no safek. He considered no safek deraita, and therefore not a safek deraita l'chumra. So again, if one follows this teaching of the Chazon Ish, then also the door is opened from a different way. But again, this does follow the Beit HaLevi and the approach of the Beit HaLevi. Again, not as quoted by the Rav, but rather as quoted by the Regina Rebbe himself. I mean, it may be worthwhile discussing, but I'm not. I'm just going to say it in passing. There is a certain degree of conservative nature within the Psak and Bnei Brak. The most extreme example of this is something which was quoted. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. There was a big debate that followed it. There's a professor from Cleveland, Professor Tzvi Yehuda, who grew up in Israel, and he wrote an article how he was close with the Chazon Ish, and he quotes from the Chazon Ish that we follow the Masorah, everything must be according to the Masorah, and the actual topic which was discussed there was really to what extent one can rely on manuscripts. So the Chazon Ish is well known for being of the opinion that anything that was not part of the Masorah one could not actually utilize. So for example, can one use the Me'iri? The Me'iri was not known for many hundreds of years. So can one use the Me'iri and Psak? I can assure you the Mishnah Berurah uses the Me'iri left and right. Can one use the Me'iri? The Chazon Ish is quoted as saying no. That was put forth by this professor Tzvi Yehuda. He goes on to say that if we were to find archaeological evidence of the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu himself wrote, and it doesn't fit into the Torah that we use today in Bnei Brak, then Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer is puzzel. I'll leave you to think about that. Later on, around a half a year later or so, Professor Schneer Lyman responded, and he showed that the Chazon Ish didn't say many of the things that Professor Yehuda accused him of saying, and that one, basically, the Chazon Ish in Professor Lyman's approach was that one could proceed with great hesitation, but it doesn't mean that automatically that anything which wasn't part of the Masorah is thereby rejected. But that issue of the Masorah is important, but I think it does contribute to the issue of, you know, as I said, this conservative approach which does emerge. Part of what I was thinking about, which I am not going to go into either, would, again, going back to the point which you said, whether it's the Beit HaLevi or the Rav, it doesn't make a difference, would be, I mean, I would assume that most of us, I don't know if you like turkey, but I would assume that most of us eat turkey. And turkey, you can begin to think about, here's something which probably we don't have a very old Masorah on turkey, and if we need a Masorah for birds, we may have some kind of a problem. And I will pause and say, I am not myself not convinced 100% that this is really an analogy. I think that it's something which is worthwhile thinking about. As I was thinking about it, I did a little bit of searching. I found the Rav Tzafanya Drori, the Rav from Kiryat Shmona, actually wrote an article about Tchelet, and he has a whole discussion about turkey in the middle, about reestablishing a Masorah, and he thinks that it's a very good analogy. I'm not 100% convinced, but it may be. But the fact that, and you, if you want a lecture on turkey, you can bring in Ari Zavatovsky. He'll talk about turkey and whales and pheasants and giraffes and all kinds of other things. But there is an issue over here of having a Masorah established. There's an interesting truth of Noda B'Yehuda who says, okay, it could be we didn't have a Masorah, but now we have a Masorah. So you say, hold it a second, but what exactly does a Masorah mean? He goes, no, now we have a Masorah. If you follow that Noda B'Yehuda, then anybody today who wants to put on Tchelet and say, we have a Masorah, people have been doing it now for how many years? Yeah, so we already have the second generation, soon you already have a third generation doing it. So according to the Tshuva of the Netziv, you now have a Masorah, and the same way you can eat turkey because you have a Masorah, you have a Masorah at this point for Tchelet. So as I said, I think that there's a whole worthwhile discussion. What ultimately the conclusion will be after doing it, is there really a fair analogy over here or not? That, as I said, I leave as, I'll leave open. I'm quoting from the Meshiv Dover, Netziv Chelik Bet Simon Kaf Bet. Ibra Kol Ze Im Hayabolof Neim Erosh. If they came to us originally to talk Turkey, right? Aval Achar Shekfar Nagula Achlam. People started eating it. Mistama Gam Az Hayal Pi Harat Chacham Shneirelo Shehumin Avoz HaTahor V'Chsaku Bezela Hetera Ein Lano Lo Osram Lo Tzi Laz Alavotenu Shalchlu Of Tami Chas V'Shom V'Eitar Negaluta Da Tami Shalchlu Mistama Lo Haya. Afilu Masorah Shehu Kosher, Aval Shoyu Midumim Shehu Min Tarnigol Ad Shiru Teotam, Ha Ilo Nodesher, there's Simon, he's going into some of the details of this, he writes, V'teida Sheheter Ha'of Indik Sha'anu Ochlem, Ha'yu Harbei Ma'orim Aleim, V'shashar V'yam Me'India, V'lo Yim Masorah Al Kashru Tam. And he goes on to say that, okay, so now we eat it, so now we have a Masorah. So as far as the Netziv is concerned, a Masorah can be reestablished. How the Netziv let his granddaughter marry the Beis HaLevi's son, I don't know. But that's a whole other question. Apparently they have two very different understandings of what the word Masorah means. Again, especially if the Rav's reporting the Beit HaLevi is the proper, as I said, something which I don't doubt. I do want to bring something else up. In 1984, I was in Rabbi Soloveitchik's shir. It was my third year in his shir. And it was actually the year that I got engaged. And I'll never forget one of my in-laws' friends, who fancied himself a Talmud Chacham, decided to ask me, so what is it that you're learning, to see if I was good enough to marry the daughter of his friends, and I said, I'm learning Menachos. So he hoped at that point, he asked, you learning about Tcheles? I said, no, we're learning about the Korban Omer. And that was the last question he asked me. That was it. Okay, Mazel Tov, and that was that. Anyway, we learned about the Korban Omer most of the winter. Around close to Rosh Chodesh, Nisan, we started learning Korban Pesach. And after Pesach, which time of the Omer, we already learned the Omer, so then we started learning Perek Tcheles. I happen to have with me the notes of the shiur that the Rav gave on Rosh Chodesh Iyar, Tav Shin Mem Kdalet. Now, these aren't my notes, and there's some real interesting things here, but the notes are truncated. I will tell you some of the things that he says, but I will also tell you what I remember. And being that it's based upon my memory, because the Rav spoke for around 2 hours and he has three sides of pages, which is absurd because the Rav, I mean, you should have around 15 pages over here. So it's the highlights. I looked at home, I couldn't find it. I don't know if I have notes from that year or not, but I remember what he said because I was amazed when he said it, especially because everyone knew the Beit HaLevi. So, we'll keep a note over here. The Rav questioned whether you need a chilazon for tchelet. Okay, 1 second. If those of you didn't get that, I'll say that again. The Rav questioned at all whether you need a chilazon to create kosher tchelet. That was the question that he was dealing with. Those of you who say, hold it, how can that even be a question? The Mishnah makes no mention of the chilazon. The Gemara talks of the chilazon, but as a way of making it. The Rambam in the Parish Mishnayot on the Mishnah that says, the Mishnah says, Atchelet ma'kevet et alavan, alavan ein ma'kevet atchelet. Sorry, Atchelet ein ma'kevet alavan, v'alavan ein ma'kevet atchelet. The Rambam writes, V'atzivu yashen sh'tin chut semer tchelet karucha lotona tzitziyot v'chut zenikra tchelet v'hu amru v'nanu al tzitra kanaf p'tiot ched v'einu etzlenu hayom l'fi sh'ein oni yodim tzvi ato. So I'm not sure what the word tzvi ato means over here. How would you translate tzvi ato? The color, or perhaps the process of the coloring? By the way, to really be more responsible, we'd have to look back at the Arabic and see exactly what word that he used and how it's being translated. I did not do all that for you, so I apologize. Over here, he only says we don't know exactly the color. In Hilchot Tzitzit Perek Bet Halacha Al-Dharam writes, Tchelet Amurah B'Torah B'Kol Makom Hi Atzemer Hatzavua Kiftoch Shebikchol Vizu hidmuta rakia hanir eit la'ayin la'ina shemish betaharosha rakia. V'tchelet amur b'tzit tzarech shetia tzviyata tzviya yidua shomenet biyofya v'lo tishtane v'kol shelo nitzva ba'oto tzviya pasul l'tzitzit afal pi shehu ka'in harakia. What did the Rambam say and what didn't he say? The Rambam over here spoke about color and he spoke about a color which doesn't fade. That's all that the Rambam says over here in Halacha Aleph. In Halacha Bet, Ketzad Sovim Tchelet Shel Tzitzit, how do you make the Tchelet of Tzitzit? So he goes on to describe the process, and then he writes, V'achakach me'ivim dag chilazon v'hu dag, and he goes on to explain what the dag is. He also says here the dag is found in Yam HaMelach, which is, I don't know how that can possibly be, I don't know how many fish are found. I mean, Yam HaMelech, it means a salt water. It doesn't mean Yam HaMelech, right? Once we went to the Dead Sea, and I asked my kids if they know what kind of fish grows here. So they said, well, I said herring. But So the Rambam, and this was the question the Rav raised. The Rav raised the question as follows. If the halacha is that tchelet has to be from a chilazon, that should have been the first thing stated. It should have said, what is tcheled? It comes from the chilazon, and then talk about it. Because the first thing is talk of its properties, and then you talk about the hechatimtza, how you do it. So the Rav said, what is the halacha? The halacha is, by tzitzit, it has to be unfading. By the way, I don't believe that the Tchelet from the Regina Rebbe is unfading. I think it fades. I do not believe it stands up to the test of the Rambam. And right on that point, there's nothing really to talk about in terms of it being the Tchelet. It just fails based upon that test. And anybody today wants to spend less money and get that Tchelet, it's just not, that's just simply not Tchelet. Again, it's not, as the Chazon Ish is quoted, in Sel Shel Tzelo Shel Safek. It's just not, it doesn't fit the criteria. The things I found in the notes over here were a little bit, again, that particular thing that I remember the Rav saying, I didn't find in the notes. What I did find in the notes is the Rav questioned why it has to be unfeigning, which he didn't quote the Uraim, and I later found it in the Uraim, that the whole mitzvah is zechira. What does zechira mean? You have to remember the mitzvah. What is zechira? Something that you don't forget. So therefore, the idea of the tchelet being unfading is a fulfillment, right? You want to talk, it's the cheftza. The cheftza of the mitzvah is in order to create an unfading memory, and that's what the zikar, and that's what the blue is and says. That's the way the Rav said it over here in the shir. But what his main point was focusing is that the din of tchelet is that it's unfading. That's what it is. But he pointed out the Rambam didn't write it the way that he should have written it had chilazon really have been the thing. Now, let's be perfectly honest on two points. One, I'm old and my memory could be going. That's what I remember him saying. Two, was he saying this lahalacha? No, he was giving a shir. He was giving a shir in Gemara Menachot, and we got to the Rambam, and he read the Rambam. He later on did compare it to the Rambam by Hilchot Klei HaMikdash, where the Rambam doesn't mention chilazon at all. There chilazon is not even mentioned. The Mishnah Lamelech says, oh, the Rambam must be basing himself on what it says over there. Other achronim don't agree. Other achronim say, no, the Rambam does not believe you need Tchelet for chilazon. Sorry, you don't need chilazon for tchelet whatsoever by Klei HaMikdash, and it's only something which possibly is by the mitzvah tzitzit. On the other hand, the Tiferet Yisrael. Anybody here see the Tiferet Yisrael? You got to the Tiferet Yisrael. So you wasted all your time tonight, except for the thing from the Rav that you didn't hear. That you did hear. Yeah. But this was said after that was published. So he could have said another case. So that's found there as well. That he said by tzitzis it doesn't have to be by tchelet at all. Doesn't need chilazon. Okay. So that I didn't see. So then my memory is right then. No, he said it. I heard him say it. I heard him say it, because no, it struck me at the time. I said, no, that's against the Beis HaLevi. Like, nobody had the guts to ask him, but the Beis HaLevi says you need a Masorah. He goes, no, that's the Rambam. The Rambam says that this is the case. Again, that's the way that I remember it. The Tiferet Yisrael, which can be found in his Hakdama to Moed, he goes through a whole discussion on the Bigdei Kohen Gadol. He starts there. And then he goes and he says, you know, Amnam, he goes, you know, I have a suffix generally regarding Tchelet. Does it have to be from Chilazon Dafka? And he starts off, he goes the other way around. He starts off by Hilchot Klei HaMikdash, where it never mentions Chilazon. So he says, obviously, by Klei HaMikdash, you don't need it. And he disagrees with the Mishnah Lamelech. Let me read. Amnam, hadavar shani mesupakpo, hu im bemet sarich l'tchelet Chilazon Dafka. Dine kfi anira mea Rambam, Klei HaMikdash, de bitchelet shebigdei kahuna ein sarich Chilazon. V'tamhani al harav mishnah lemelech sham sheratzalom sheram samech al atzmo al mashakatuv behilchot tzitzit. The tchelet shebitzit tzarech chilazon. V'kmo kain dinokan. And he says, lofi niyataiti, ef shalom akein. He goes on to a whole discussion why he doesn't believe. You can say that in the Rambam behilchot kli hamikdash. He then continues and he says, V'kevin shehochachnu sheletchelet shetzarech lebigdei kahuna lo hayetzarech chilazon dafka imkein hu hadin legabit tzitzit ein tzarech chilazon dafka debishneim lo nizkarak miletchelet v'chein nir miloshen ha-gemara. He goes, hold it a second. The Torah never said chelet. Sorry, the Torah never said chilazon, it said chelet. The Mishnah never said chelet. The Mishnah says, I'm going backwards here. The Mishnah never said chilazon, it said tchelet. He goes, therefore, what do you need? You need tchelet. So the only question is, what is tchelet? So he says, the Rambam defined what tchelet is. It's something which, by tzitzit, has to be something which is unfading. So again, he goes to that exact svara that the Rav said, which I don't believe he quoted the Tver Yisrael, and he says, no. That when it comes down to it, the chilazon is just a hechatimtza. It's a very good way of making something which is unfading. Now, if this is true, then the whole discussion of the Masorah becomes completely unnecessary, because then by definition, it's not something that you need a Masorah for. And the whole objection of the Beit HaLevi, that no, to make Tchelet, you need specifically the Chilazon, you need a Masorah, the same way you have Masorah and Etrog, you need a Masorah, what the Chilazon is no longer an issue, because then, according to what the Tiferet Yisrael and the Rav said in the Rambam, that's not a criteria whatsoever. So when I went through my own processing on this, it goes back to the first question I raised. What do you have to lose? Safik deraita l'chumrah. Safik deraita l'chumrah. You have an ability of preparing, of fulfilling a mitzvah, which Jews have been unable to fulfill for many, many hundreds of years. So again, what is the downside? When you take into consideration the scientific evidence, which Rav Yashiv is absolutely not, and he has a very cynical comment, the scientists say this today, tomorrow they say something else, and again, any person who smokes says the same thing, they say it's bad for you today, tomorrow it'll be good for you. By the way, it won't be good for you tomorrow, just in case you're not sure, it's not going to be good for you tomorrow. So there's a basic distrust of the whole scientific community there, so all the scientific evidence is pushed to the side. So basically, the tchelet, which is around today, from the Murex, according to certain Haredi poskim, it's the same thing as whatever was put forward 100 years ago by the Reziner, a little more 100 years ago by the Reziner, so therefore there's nothing to talk about. However, that's not so simple, there's nothing to talk about. Part of the objections there, she'ain tzel tzelo shel safek. There's no doubt that it wasn't right. He just thought, he went in what he thought was the best candidate, and let's try something over here. That seems to be the approach. The Murex that we have today, I'm just going to go in a couple of different directions, which is really finishing up. One direction that we can go is that if what the Rav was saying from the Beit HaLevi that you need a Masorah, and the Rav was saying that when it comes to the Tchelet, you need a Masorah, so then it's a non-starter, there's nothing to talk about, and I understand the students of the Rav who say, okay, listen, I can't wear Tchelet. If we take the Rav's approach by Masorah regarding what he quotes from the Beit HaLevi, that it has to be something which was passed on, you can't create a Masorah by Svara, so at that point you get stuck, but the only question is Tchelet one of these things? The Beit HaLevi thought it was. So it could be that within the Soloveitchik family tradition, so the Beit HaLevi thought it was. So again, it's a non-starter. On the other hand, the Netziv, which is also from the Soloveitchik family, from the other side, right? Chaim was married to the granddaughter of the Netziv. So according to the Netziv, you can jumpstart a Masorah. The fact that people have been doing this for a couple generations, that makes it a Masorah. That makes it tradition. Now, if that sounds very strange, that is 100% not what the Beit HaLevi says, but it is 100% what the Netziv says. As I said, I still have a question mark whether you really make this analogy between turkeys and between Tchelet. So that's something which, as I said, is worthwhile investigating. If you consider the Tver Yisrael, and now you realize it's not just the Tver Yisrael who said this. The Rav also said this as his understanding of the Rambam, at least as a Havamin, at least he said it in the Shir. Again, that part, I can assure you that he said it in the Shir, that no one ever said it needs to come from Chilazon, that the properties need to be something which is unfading. And I can assure you that the Ptil Tchelet produced tzitzit have been with me through many times wash, have been to the dry cleaners, have been, and they never fade one iota. They don't run, they don't fade. Again, I don't get paid for this, and they charge me as much as they charge anybody else to buy the things. Well, you really feel you're doing a mitzvah. It costs more than the esrog does. Then these don't fade. And if the criteria is, in fact, unfading blue, as the Tiferet Yisrael and the Rav said, so then, do you have a suffix deraita? Maybe it's a suffix, maybe it's not a suffix. Maybe it's not even a suffix. Maybe this is a mitzvah deraita. So therefore it's a mitzvah deraita. So again, suffix deraita b'chum, if it's a mitzvah deraita, then certainly one is obligated to keep a mitzvah deraita. And that was my basic thinking. My only hesitation was that my father wouldn't do it, because my father feels himself very much to be a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and my father said, if Rav Aaron Lichtenstein will start doing it, then I'll start doing it. So I don't know how many conversations you had with Rav Aaron. My father asked Rav Aaron. And Rav Aaron said, I'm very conservative. Of course, Rav Aaron had to say with a small c and so on. And Rav Aaron said, I'm very conservative and I don't very quickly change my behavior and whatever. And Rav Aaron knows who he is and he knows that if he changes it, then it's basically a game changer. And he didn't feel that he wanted to, now that he shirks from responsibility. He didn't. He does feel he's enough of the Soloveitchik family. The Beit HaLevi's position bothers him. I never discussed this with him. I did discuss it with my brother, who did write the whole book on from the Rav's teachings on tzitzit and so on. And one thing my brother, who doesn't wear tchelet, my brother did say that if you're already going to wear it, you're suffic, then you may as well follow the. He goes, you may as well follow Tosfot. You may as well put four strings of which I didn't do. I do it as the Ravid. And the most complicated thing when I decided to start keeping is how do you tie the thing? I have no Masorah, right? How do you tie this what position? And I ended up following the Gra because I figure that the Gra is pretty good. And and yeah. And you end up doing it according to Rashi. You end up following a couple of Shitot Rishonim if you do it this way. I chas v'shalom, I'm not paskening for anybody over here how people go and decide what they do. I'm sure that they have their own ways of figuring out what it is that they do. I just want people who don't do it to feel guilty. So that was the sole objective. Do I get percentages if the sales go up? Yeah.
So you said, what is there to lose by having a tailor as opposed to not having? Is there actually something that if you're wearing a tailor or you're wearing this color and it's not, that you're not necessarily being
a tailor? No. Some achronim bring. Some objections. Look, there's a big question why, if you don't have tchelet, why you need more. Let's say, according to Rashi, there were four and four, right? So if you don't have tchelet, maybe you should only have four streams and not eight. Who even said that you fill in the others with eight? There are those who bring an objection that the color of the tzitzit should be the same color as the beged. So therefore, it would seem to me that if you wore a blue beged, then you would have solved those problems as well. Again, if one is really concerned about that. But I've only seen that among a number of Achronim. I didn't see any of the Rishonim bring that as an objection. Yes? What's the question? The Maharil. Where the Maharil bring... He was concerned that the ability of breaking the law of Kliyim would only apply if you were fulfilling the mitzvah with tchelet. And if it wasn't real tchelet, so then you would be breaking the Isser of Kliyim. The solution is where wool sits it with wool strings. Don't make it out of pishtun. I'm not so concerned because I think it's real tchelet, but no. Yes. What else? What other questions you want to answer that I don't know the answer to?
Other mitzvot, the title of Tehillim and other Jewish government. Is that it? Okay, I'm just wondering what other. That's not Jewish. Okay.
You want to talk about Korban Pesach? So why would we could talk about the Korban Pesach. If you look at Yaakov Ettlinger's Shelot and Tshuvot, it's called the Binyan Tzion because the first, I don't recall, around 15, 16, 17 questions all are involved in the mitzvah when you come back to Eretz Yisrael about opportunities that we haven't had before, Korban Pesach, others. So if you want, you can certainly look there.
Also, was asked, because one of his main points was you can't lose. So he said, yeah, they said it in the Chazon Ish also, and he said, yeah, it's just like somebody who was wearing glasses without the glasses inside of the frame.
I have the quote here. I have it here. Yes.
Okay, he says you can't lose, you can't gain, but you're not getting anything. It's like you're making fun of it. That's like ridiculous. But I never understood that. I mean, first of all, you have an actual Chazon Ish said that.
I have Reb Chaim Kinevsky quoting Chanish saying it in this book, Ma'ase Ish, Shamati Sha'ana La'achasha Ta'an, Im Lo Yo'il, Lo Yazik, Omar Lo, Shebekosova, Hoya Echad Shalach Mishkafayim Beliz Chuchit, Vamar Im Lo Yo'il, Lo Yazik, Ula Echad Amar Kachdam Shor, Vitzavat Etzit. Meaning, the Chazon Ish was so convinced that the Regina was wrong, he said there's no upside. But again, the fact that you're quoting the Chazon Ish regarding the Regina Tcheles has nothing to do with the Tcheles which they're charging on for, like for today.
For argument, I have a good friend who got the job only after he started wearing plain glass. He was having a terrible time finding a job. Everybody said, he was too young, put on glasses, no prescription. And he got the job. He got four offers within the week.
So Baruch Hashem, we come from a very deep society. But yeah, so Reb Chaim Kinevsky quotes this. I just don't understand the relevance either. It's only within the context of him saying in tzel shel safek that it was right. But I think that today we have something sheyesh tzel shel safek that it's right. So therefore, this argument is really not all that relevant. I also found it very demeaning and not. That's why I don't. I'm in enough trouble with any followers of the Chazon Ish as it is, so I didn't feel that I should go any further and quote
there. Isn't there a tradition that the chilazon is once every 70 years?
Yes.
So
the question is what it means. There is among Chazal many, many discussions, where it's found, how it's found, how, and so on. I can show you all kinds of...
It now on a regular basis that it can't be the real chilazon.
We said we don't need chilazon.
Unless the way that they're looking for it is more effective than it once did. Question. As I said, in the Maseches Ketanos and Sittis there, it says once in 7 years. The question, I think what it means is that it's something which is very rare and something which is expensive. And it's not like the Kala Ilon, which was something which was very, very popular. Anyway, as I said, this was not a talk Halacha L'maisa. It was a talk about Tcheles. Again, it's I told you with me there was some sight of the Shmaya, but there was I find it an incredible privilege to be able to be behind this mitzvah and hopefully the way that the Torah had intended it. And I can't tell you in terms of the experience of saying the Shema and saying the third parak of the Shema and Re'isim Oso and looking at it and seeing the Tcheles, you have a different Kiyum HaMitzvah than you have when you look at it and you don't have the Psil Tcheles.